Welcome to the Sunshine Economy, faster, bigger, deeper, trade and logistics in South Florida. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. It all started with a simple question.
What size are your shoes?
That was the text I received while en route to meet Chris Hodgkins. Chris is a vice president with Matt Concessionaire. That's the conglomerate formed to dig two tunnels, just over 3/4 mile each, under government cut, between Watson Island and Dodge Island. We were meeting Chris to get a tour of the Miami Tunnel less than 2 weeks of the planned ribbon cutting, May 19th.
What size are your shoes?
What size are your shoes was the question. A project like the Miami Tunnel comes with an impressive list of numbers. The depth of the tunnels, the diameter, the amount of concrete and cable, security cameras, traffic capacity, the cost, certainly the cost. But a shoe size? It seemed trivial. Almost too personal. It's 9.5, by the way. But then we got to the tunnel. Construction workers were installing 50-ton floodgates at the tunnel entrances and grinding parts of the pavement to allow for better traction when the traffic starts to roll later this month. We were in Chris's Bobcat, a souped-up golf cart running on diesel, with no windshield, by the way, to get into this $1 billion investment into the future of trade in South Florida.
So we're heading down. We're heading into the tunnel. This is on the east side of this tunnel, as we've got to be pretty close now underneath the 50-ton gates you guys are installing. We've got to be right at sea level, essentially.
Right. So right here, what we have, you see the intensity of the lighting. This is called transitional lighting. It's not on right now, but this will be a very bright area. So as you go from the very sunny, bright port, you're going to transition into the lighting here. What we have in here is we have over 600 miles of conduits and wiring. We have 44 jet fans that monitor the air through 8 specialized ventilation and air monitors. And you can feel the cool here.
Yeah. Big temperature change there.
It's nice. We're very proud of this. We're proud about being on time and on budget. Right here, this is a cross passage. We have 5 cross passages that go from one tunnel tube to the other tunnel tube. This cross passage, we were able to dig. I'm going to show you the one down here. We had a freeze at minus 27 below zero for 60 days. And once the ground was frozen, we were able to cut through and chip our way over.
Is that because of the slurried nature of the limestone bedrock here?
Right, when we got down to strata number 5 and started to go underneath government cut, the coral stone is like a Swiss cheese. You have pockets of hard, hard, abrasive rock, and then you have pockets of slurry. But unfortunately, some of the pockets of slurry turned out to be the size of a Buick, and then farther under government cut, they were the size of a city block. So we had to inject 50,000 cubic yards of grout, a cement-like substance, of grout under the ground so that at 100 feet below sea level, our tunnel boring machine was hitting a solid surface to make all that cutting go that much easier.
How did you do that here in hot and humid Miami?
Well, when we were doing it, hot and humid Miami turned into a nice cool tunnel. we injected a brine that we piped down from the surface, and that brine that we pumped in would freeze. So it looked like a big icicle down the side of the tunnel. And that big icicle would actually keep the tunnel cool through the long, hot summer as we were building the interior of the tunnel. And once we brought that whole area down to about 10 below zero, we were able to have a concrete cutter cut through our segments, chip through the earth, and come out on the other side. This cross passage right here is 62 feet long.
Chris, we're still on the incline going down. I can see ahead of us the tunnel takes a little bit of a jog to the northwest.
Where are we? Right now, we're still under government cut. Now, about here, we come out from underneath the water, and now I'm underneath the earth, and this turn here takes me underneath MacArthur Causeway, straightens out, and I'm going to come out right past Jungle Island. So right now we're at a 5-degree grade coming out. If you're a cruise passenger headed off to MIA, or you're a cargo truck headed out to a warehouse in Hialeah.
Or in Doral or other locations in West Dade County where warehouses have been sprouting up over the past couple of years. 8 big new warehouses have opened in the last year alone, and vacancy rates have been dropping. We will visit one of those new warehouses later on in this program. But first, back to our tunnel tour with Chris Hodgkins, Vice President of Matt Concessionaire, as we exit the tunnel emerging at Port Miami.
Okay, so now you're in the eastbound. This is what it's all about.
So this would be an empty cargo truck coming in to pick up a container or a cruise passenger coming to the Caribbean.
This is what it's all about right here. So you just came off of 95 or the 836. You're headed to the port. Now you just came out. You're in the right-hand lane. And what do you see right above you? Exactly where you're going. No traffic light directly to cargo. There's Seaboard Marine. And then to show you the dichotomy here, if you're a cruise passenger, look over there. There's our cruise terminal. There's our cruise parking. There's 6 ships. So that's what it's all about. It's about getting here safer, quicker, and free.
Those are 3 of the reasons that led to the $1 billion dig. Alleviate most cargo truck traffic from the surface streets of downtown Miami. 16,000 trucks and cars now drive through downtown, traveling across Port Boulevard to and from Dodge Island, the home of Port Miami. Cargo, cruise ship passengers, and workers make the trek. The tunnel will take cars and most cargo trucks, except for those too big or carrying restricted cargo. The traffic is one reason, but another behind the push to build the tunnel is about 1,150 miles to the south. The widening of the Panama Canal set off an arms race of sorts for ports. A wider canal will accommodate bigger cargo ships, especially to and from Asia. And ports like Port Miami have been racing to build bigger and deeper to accept those ships. In Miami, that has led to the tunnel, but also dredging the port's main channel, digging out up to 10 feet more to give it a depth of as much as 52 feet. Miami is one of at least a half dozen American ports undergoing massive expansions. Houston, Baltimore, and Savannah are among those in varying stages of expanding in hopes of capturing the bigger ships expected to come through the Panamanian locks. As big and as complex as the tunnel project is, so is the financing. It's a 3P project, public-private partnership. It's a 35-year relationship between the Florida Department of Transportation and Matt Concessionaire, the conglomerate formed for the project. The state picks up half the tab for design and construction, the other half coming from the county and city. Once open, Matt Concessionaire will be responsible for operating the tunnel, with the state paying the freight. We spoke about the business of operating the tunnel with Chris Hodgkins of Matt back inside his trailer office on Watson Island.
So we have to operate that tunnel in a way that keeps the tunnel open. For example, we'll have tow trucks at either end of the tunnel. We have a control room that's 24/7, 365, every day, every hour, the whole year long. And what that ensures is that we continue to monitor that traffic to make sure it's flowing. For example, we have in the tunnel over 91 cameras. We have an incident detection visibility device that will pull out anything that's out of the norm. For example, the tunnel's designed for cruise traffic and cargo traffic. But if a bicyclist goes in there, alarm sound, response teams respond to that. Same thing with if a truck stops in the middle of the road. It means there's a deviant activity.
Give me an idea of what the business model is after you turn the quote-unquote keys over to Miami-Dade County government. You come in as the vendor to operate. What's the business model look like?
Well, it's called availability payments. It's one of the first done here in the state of Florida. So everything that happens in that tunnel is recorded. So if a truck breaks down, we've got 10 minutes to get there and to start to clear the scene. So all of that has to take place. All of that means that, we'll have 2 tow trucks on either end that can both push and pull. And don't forget, we're in Miami. So you know what that means? That means exotic cars. So we have to have a tow truck that doesn't just hook your vehicle and pull you out, because we've got Bentleys and Maseratis and Lamborghinis.
And Peterbilts and others, right?
Yeah, you're right. So for the Peterbilt, we have a special truck designed for heavy 18-wheeler trucks. For the Lamborghini, we've got a tow truck that just slides underneath.
So you guys will get paid based upon the availability of the tunnel. The more often it's open, free, and clear, the higher the revenue can be back to the company.
Well, based on a standard, it's called performance standards. We don't just have to keep it open. We have to keep it clean. We have to keep it pristine. And we got to keep it up to performance standards that are then audited and monitored. So we're looking forward to it. We have a team that's been training now for over a month that's getting ready to operate this tunnel. And by the end of May, we'll be going through that tunnel. And it'll be something that we're going to think is here for a long time.
For Miami-Dade, it's a public-private partnership, as we know. What kind of traffic do you anticipate? What kind of return on the investment that's been done on the public side do you think is going to be necessary?
Well, we're going to have over 26,000 vehicles go through there a day. And
that's trucks and cars, right?
That's trucks and cars. But then you've got Monday with six ships in port, both disembarking and embarking. So we can go up to as high as 30, 40,000 cars on that day. So just going in and out of the tunnel. So that really will matter. It'll be for a cleaner, more crisp, more functional entrance and exit to the tunnel, while at the same time making sure that cargo, which the port is all about, and all about the post-Panamex response to that, is ready for the future.
Chris Hodgkins with Matt Concessionaire, the consortium building and operating the Port Miami Tunnel. Still to come, playing host to the post-Panamax cargo ships today.
But we already have the vessels call here that would need the deeper draft. They just come in lighter loaded and higher up out of the water to come in here.
This is the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. Port Miami is not the only port in South Florida expanding. Port Everglades and Fort Lauderdale actually does more trade business with Latin America than Port Miami does. According to data from international trade media firm World City, Miami's top Latin American trading partners accounted for $2.5 billion in the first quarter. Port Everglades did over $3 billion worth of business with its top Latin American trading partners during the same time. Port Everglades CEO and director Steve Cernak welcomes the Panama Canal expansion, but he does not see a huge impact coming on Port Everglades.
Predominantly, we're a north-south trade lane port. We view the Panama Canal as providing us some opportunity to have some interconnectivity, but we already have the vessels call here that would need the deeper draft. They just come in lighter loaded and higher up out of the water to come in here. So I view the Panama Canal discussion as beneficial for the nation as a whole. It's focused in the conversation right now on the need to invest in waterside infrastructure, and that's good. I think that we have to create a win-win environment for the entire port network, which ultimately will benefit the American consumer.
Steve, do you see the widening of the canal greatly impacting the business, the cargo business here at Port Everglades?
To some degree, like I said, it's going to have some effect. I think that if we can introduce one or two services, that's an east-west trade lane, that's about the extent of it. If I look to other neighboring ports, my neighbor to the south, they predominantly have east-west cargo moves, so it benefits them to a greater extent than I see it benefiting us, but there are some synergies there. And I don't think anybody really knows how this is going to play out until it's actually constructed, because there's too many moving pieces going on right now. We can plan for it and say, oh, we're going to bring this business to this port, or I'm going to bring it to that port, but the shipping lines themselves are going through a consolidation to reduce their expenses. The focus is on moving all of these goods in a cost-effective manner, which ultimately is reflected in consumer prices. And until that shakeout is complete and we see how these consolidations merge, I don't think anybody has a really clear picture on exactly what the Panama Canal is going to mean.
Are you satisfied that the north-south trade routes that Port Everglades services mostly are going to continue the kinds of trade volumes that you anticipate when the Panama widening is complete?
Yes. That market has grown tremendously. And numbers that I just saw this morning continue to support that the import numbers for last month over month comparison grew by double digits.
How do those import numbers look of cargo coming into Port Everglades, and where's it coming from?
Well, we have the East Coast of Central and South America predominantly, and as well as the Mediterranean and European markets.
And what kind of categories?
Well, apparel, perishables is a big part of our staple here. Bananas, melons, grapes.
Those grapes are new, part of a pilot program that began last fall, bringing certain fruits directly into South Florida instead of the previous requirement to bring grapes into the U.S. from northern ports due to concerns about foreign bugs. The grape program allows the fruit to be imported directly if certain refrigeration requirements are met. The expansion at Port Everglades includes a new rail yard, traffic flow improvements, lengthening the turning notch, which involves some 70,000 new mangroves to add new berths, and cargo cranes. Port Everglades also wants to deepen its main channel and is awaiting a final report from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Now, as the CEO Steve Cernak told us, Port Everglades can already accommodate the bigger super post-Panamax ships. They just can't be fully loaded.
Has the delay in the deepening of the channel cost Port Everglades business? Is there an opportunity cost to the delays that you've seen and experienced?
There's always the lost revenue opportunities that will never be recovered. Yes, because the vessels calling here could use the water today. If they had come in fully loaded, they would have been used more efficiently. That's additional revenue opportunity to the port. But it is what it is. We're trying to work through those issues. It's unfortunate, but it's what we have to deal with, and we're trying to solve the issues. There is a commitment from the Corps to have this all completed this calendar year, which it looks like there is a light at the end of the tunnel.
What's the role of a port, of any singular port, in the global supply chain?
Well, if you look at the prototypical diagram of the logistics pipeline, we're really just a small component of that pipeline, albeit an important one. We're a intermodal interface where you change from one mode of transportation to the other. If you look at Fort Lauderdale and Miami, can one port take on the operations of both ports? And the answer is no. Ports have grown up around their communities. It would be nice to have a cohesive national freight strategy and policy in place, because what gets lost here is we're talking about waterside infrastructure investments, but we also just have a discussion about rail investments, highway investments. My contention is that when you take that and compare it to waterside investments that are needed, they're all going to have their own competing interests, but there's going to be some common ground there. And when you get into that common ground area and you start looking how the pieces fit, then we can have a discussion on moving goods the most cost-effective and efficient way, and where we can get the most for our investment dollars.
Steve Cernak, CEO and Director at Port Everglades. Still to come, quicker, better, cheaper. The challenge of the global supply chain.
It's just about a movement. If I want to take grapes out of Chile, how do I get the grapes from the field to the shelf to the consumer with less people involved, with less days involved, and at a higher quality of maintaining that temperature?
This is the Sunshine Economy, faster, bigger, deeper, trade and logistics in South Florida. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. The hundreds of millions of dollars that have and will be spent expanding ports in South Florida are aimed at making the movement of goods faster and more cost-efficient. That's the logistics side of the trade business. Tracking, storing, sorting, moving, all that stuff that goes in and out of the seaports and airports are huge economic engines of trade. A Florida East Coast Railway train pulls up next to the South Florida Logistics Center that's just west of Miami International Airport. 7 miles to Port Miami, 29 miles to Port Everglades. One building is complete and fully leased. Two more will be finished this summer. This project by Flagler Global Logistics is a very visible sign of confidence in South Florida's growing stature in international trade.
This is probably the most unique property from a logistics perspective in the country because of the connectivity of land, sea, and air. We can get by any mode of transportation anywhere.
That's Chris Scott, president and CEO of Flagler Global Logistics.
What kind of economic activity does this development represent, do you think, for trade and for South Florida?
Well, it's providing a classy warehouse, a destination that has quick access to MIA, access to both ports. So whether it's coming down into Miami to go out, this location can bring it in, consolidate it, get it on containers, get it to the ship, or get it to the airport to be shipped out. Whether it's coming in through either one of those locations, this location is connected. This is probably the most unique property from a logistics perspective in the country because of the connectivity of land, sea, and air. We can get by any mode of transportation anywhere.
This location where we're at, Chris, we're just west of MIA. We are just east of the Palmetto. And as the signs say here on our model, 7 miles to Port Miami, 29 miles to Port Everglades. What kind of things are going to come through here when all these warehouses are built?
Well, we're still projecting that this 2 million square feet, at least half of it will be cold storage. And probably half of our building one is going to be cold storage. We're going to walk out and take a look at it, some of it when we get done.
So fruits, vegetables, perishables.
It's a big importer coming out of Latin America, and that's a big focus for us. Flowers will be in here quite often, a lot of flowers. The majority of the flowers coming into the country are coming through MIA. We think this is going to be a destination where there's many flower companies going to move and consolidate in here.
When you're buying flowers for Mother's Day, how good are the odds that someone with Flagler may have touched them?
In the next 2 or 3 years, the odds are probably greater than 50% we'll touch them or we'll pass through our property.
So we've walked out in building one into the warehouse space. And Chris, in front of me, I see 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, at least 12 bays for trucks to pull up into. You know, when you walk through here, you realize that despite all the efficiencies, despite the computerized technologies at the port and the big cranes, it's still a very physical business.
It is. You know, distribution is a physical business. It is still labor intensive, but it's this building's only open 5 months, so there's still a lot of things that we're going to do from racking and technology that will make this more efficient. The technology today far exceeds what it was 10 years ago. If we could put 10,000 SKUs into this building, and you would have the right technology that would be built on a forklift, you could tell anybody anywhere where any item is and how to get it and how to get it to the front dock in the shortest motion. So, and that kind of technology we will get to as we continue to grow.
Gotcha. What's this space here? This is cold storage?
This is all the cold storage space. It's going to get loud in here. You can see in this room here we have repacking services. So we have a blueberry machine, a citrus machine, that we bring in bulk and we can actually repack to those clamshells that you see you buy in a store.
Yeah.
A lot of the fruits and vegetables that come in has to go through either a cold storage or fumigation process. So we have that capability of doing that. And our process is very unique in the industry. It's patent pending, and we believe that we're going to change how that industry works.
Flagler is a big diversified company, lots of different interests. You're providing a lot of different services for your logistics customers. One of those areas of improvement, efficiencies that you're working on is fumigation, is providing kind of the washing of this produce.
What's the opportunity there?
Well, the opportunity is significant because it is not done on any scale in South Florida. It's mostly done up in the Northeast. So all of the majority of the product in Florida is being handled in the Northeast. So the opportunity for Floridians that we can grow this up, we can grow this business, will one, provide jobs, will two, will take costs out of the supply chain, which will actually give the retailers a better cost of product, which could reduce, should reduce pricing at the store, and it would reduce shrink. And shrink is one of the biggest costs to a retailer in the business.
What's shrink?
Shrink is waste. If they display 20 pounds of grapes and throw 2 pounds away, they got 20% shrink.
It's cold in here.
It's cold in here. Oh my God.
From his vantage point, Chris Scott, the CEO of Flagler Global Logistics, can see the picture of trade throughout South Florida and beyond. We spoke about that in the quieter surroundings off the warehouse floor.
Well, in South Florida, the trade industry is really starting to pick up. And with the things that are happening at the port in Miami and Port Everglades and MIA, they're becoming more and more instrumental into the trade of what's happening, particularly in coming out of Latin America. South Florida controls 25% of all the trade coming from Latin America, and 70% of what happens in South Florida is dealing with Latin America. And the economies in Latin America are booming, they're growing, and as those economies grow, a lot of that comes over to us, and Miami being probably the capital of Latin America is getting a push into that trade market.
We have seen the Brazilian economy slow down some. We've seen significant inflation worries in Argentina. Obviously, the political and economic hollowing out in Venezuela. Colombia remains strong. Some of the Central American countries remain strong as well. Where within Latin America do you see that real significant trade impact in South Florida in the ports and Flagler's business?
In our business, particularly, it's right now it's Chile and it's Peru. Peru has been growing at 6% or more in their economy. The agriculture in North Peru, we deal primarily with perishables at this time. The agriculture in North Peru is really taking off. Chile is obviously one of the major importers of perishables for our country. And so those two areas are still very strong and they're very important to us. So I don't really see an issue with those areas.
The arms race, so to speak, that we've seen within the ports on the East Coast to get ready to accept the post-Panamax ships has been significant. Hundreds of millions of dollars spent here in South Florida in Port Miami and other ports prepared. Is the competitive edge of geography, Miami being the first East Coast port out of a widening Panama Canal, is that an opportunity in the long term, or what does Miami and South Florida specifically have to do to maintain that geographic opportunity?
I like the way you said that, the arms race, because that's actually what's happening. Everybody along the East Coast is trying to find a way to capitalize on the Panama Canal expansion and the influx of trade that's really jumping. Geography, obviously, is the number one thing. Miami is the first stop. And in logistics, it's really all about efficiency and reducing travel. And it doesn't matter if it's someone in your warehouse that's driving a pallet jack or it's a tractor trailer or it's a ship. The less travel I can have, the less cost I will spend, and the more speed to shelf I will have. Miami is that first stop coming from Latin America. So geography is obviously that, but it's also cost. So if you can bring it into Miami, there's a lot of cost you can take out of the network and a lot of efficiency you can gain for all the customers that are trying to import those products.
How much of that is true if that product winds up in the Southeast? So it goes on the ship, gets off Port Miami or Port Everglades, gets put on a truck, gets put on I-95 or across Alligator Alley up I-75 or on a rail bed. Is that truly a cost savings for the end consumer? Is that an efficiency?
Well, we run some numbers of the ships that's going into the Northeast, and if the ship stops into Miami, it will take 3 to 5 days out of the supply chain and as much as $2,500 to $3,000 per truckload out of the system.
So if a shipper puts their bulk container onto Port Miami or Port Everglades off the boat from the Panama Canal, you're saying that product gets to market up to a week faster, almost a week faster, and at $3,000 less?
Correct. Yes.
Are energy costs a factor in that?
Well, diesel fuel is a major factor in that. It runs the ship. It runs the truck. Right. Fuel is the biggest factor. Fuel will cost you more than buildings cost you anymore. And as fuel keeps rising, that cost keeps going up.
So in this calculation that makes South Florida ports less expensive for importers for product into the United States, even if they're going up to the Southeast, what role does fuel play in that?
Well, fuel plays a huge role. If product is coming into Miami and it has to be the final destination is going to be Orlando or Jacksonville or even Atlanta, if product goes into New York and has to get to Atlanta, the ship's got to go north. Then the product's got to come south. If you just run the miles, the fuel it takes to burn, to help that ship get to New York, and the fuel it takes for that tractor to get down is significantly reduced, and therefore the cost is.
A lot of the Asian traffic is going to the West Coast, Long Beach and Seattle specifically. Does the East Coast have any hope of competing for that West Coast traffic when the widened Panama Canal opens up and the deeper ports here on the East Coast are ready to accept those ships?
You know, that's an interesting debate. The East Coast answer is yes, and the West Coast answer is no.
Yeah. It's like a rap battle from the 1990s here, right?
So the guys in California say it will have no effect in the big scheme of things, but the East Coast people say it will.
Yeah.
It'll just come down to economics. The shipping companies are going to look at what their cost is to land on the West Coast, and then the product get trucked to Chicago or the Midwest or even all the way to New York. And the East Coast is going to do the same economics. So it's just a matter of when you do the math, when that lane opens up and you compare it head-to-head, that's what's going to matter. It would seem to me, understanding this industry, that product will be coming to the East Coast. The question will be where the line will be. New York will probably come to the East Coast. Anything along the Eastern Seaboard will probably come. What does Chicago do? Right. Does it go to the West Coast? I don't know the answer to that. That'll be more the economics of it.
Let's talk about the economics of logistics and time to market and efficiency in fuel. Those are the two big things. But the third is just real estate. These bulky containers need some place to go, and we know real estate in South Florida is already a premium. We're squeezed between two great bodies of water, the ocean and the Everglades. Is there enough cheap land that Flagler has that they're putting warehouses on to keep the efficiencies in the economic models to provide the kind of growth that you want to see?
Well, you know, one of the big things about our business model, which is very unique in a third-party logistics, is that we actually own real estate. We, in the entire state of Florida, we own over 1,400 acres and have entitled space to build over 24 million square feet. We have a third of the entitled space in South Florida alone, and we are building Class A warehouses. And our vacancy rate in South Florida is about 5%, which is half of what it was 3 or 4 years ago.
That's pretty low for warehouse space, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes. So we actually are leasing the buildings prior to completion with some tenants that need to upgrade to a better building, some that need more space, some that are new in the market. And it's really starting to jump that way. Now, to get back to the question of the container, the other thing that Miami can offer is really a transload situation with containers.
What's transload situation?
The container comes off the ship, it comes into a local warehouse, you empty the container, and then it either goes on the rail or it goes on a tractor trailer and goes north. A lot of freight comes south in Florida. It's the way it's made. Not a lot of freight goes north. Yeah. The freight that actually is coming through the ports and the airport will allow us the opportunity to make that happen. Therefore, that container can get turned and put back on the ship to go south rather than the container landing in a north port, getting put on a chassis and getting dragged across the country, and now those containers have to find a home.
Do you see those containers that have the potential of being emptied out here in South Florida getting filled in South Florida as they head back?
I do. One of the things that is on our radar that we haven't focused as much on is particularly the agriculture in Florida, whether it's oranges or whatever it is, that we have an opportunity to move product out of South Florida. Electronics move out of South Florida. There's many things that we want to try to take advantage of those containers going south that we want to put product on.
Chris, compare the opportunity of exports out of South Florida for this community, but also the industry and for Flagler, versus accepting imports into this region?
The biggest thing with logistics in South Florida is there's no real roadmap. There's a lot of people doing it and dabbling in it and understanding it. And we think the ports here are busy. They're not near as busy as they are on the West Coast, but they're projecting the ports are going to jump by 30% over the next 10 years. And if you take two ports going by 30%, not including what MIA will do, the amount of volume is going to grow significantly. So in order to do that, there's going to become some bigger players in the logistics industry in South Florida, which we hope and plan to be one of those that will help control that export and import.
It's somewhat of a fractured industry here in South Florida. In other words, a few mid-sized players and a lot of smaller players. But is the infrastructure ready for the kind of growth that is projected to be seen at the two seaports as well as the airports?
Not quite yet, but it's headed that way. The tunnel going on at Port of Miami, we now have our sister company, Florida East Coast Railroad, has on-dock service in Port Everglades. What's happening with MIA and all they do with Latin America. As you see in this site, we have entitled space to build 2 million square feet of industrial space on this site that I could say I'd hit a golf ball and hit one of the planes, but my ball usually doesn't go straight. So all right, we're right next to the airport. By rail, we're connected to both ports. That never hits a public road, so all containers can come through by rail, or we can pull them by truck. And so I think what we're doing here is going to become a major hub and a major player in that.
What do you see as the challenges to developing this as a major hub? First and foremost, quality workforce. Do you have it? Do you sense that it's coming?
No, I feel very good about the workforce in Miami. I think the good thing about Miami is the diversity of culture. And there are people, the pay is good down here. It's fair. About 3% of the private sector works in the logistics industry. The average pay is in excess of $40,000. Some jobs will probably be a little less. Some will be a little more than that. And I feel very good about the workforce. We have had no problems with finding, whether it's direct labor or leadership, to work into our business.
Chris Scott, President and CEO of Flagler Global Logistics. Still to come, the view from 1,150 miles south from the Panama Canal.
Panama, it's really the gateway for Latin America and even the United States. We want to take away a little bit of the business from Miami.
This is the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. It was 100 years ago when a French boat became the first self-propelled ocean-going vessel to transverse the continent by going through the Panama Canal. It signaled a new beginning in what was a $375 million project a century ago to slice Central America, forming a 50-mile vein through which world trade has flowed ever since. It was 15 years ago when the U.S. handed back the canal territory to the Panamanians, and 7 years since the effort to widen the canal began, helping spark projects at East Coast ports in the U.S. in the race to capture the bigger ships. But the competition may not be confined to American waters. Jorge Quiano is the Panamanian Canal Authority Administrator. He hopes Panama itself can become more of a destination instead of a watery way stop in the global trade supply chain.
We want to take away a little bit of the business from Miami. For example, there's some electronic stuff that actually goes through Panama, through the Panama Canal, and ends up in Miami. And then in Miami, the distributor puts it back on another ship and brings it back to Panama. I mean, that to me is a little bit ridiculous, but that's the way it pans out because the distributors are there in Miami.
The port next door to the canal's Caribbean locks is the Manzanillo International Terminal. Carlos Uriola is the executive vice president there.
The cargo we are competing is a cargo that can be in Miami. It can be in Freeport, Bahamas. It can be in Jamaica. It can be in Caicedo. It can be everywhere. So we are competing. Miami always was one of our main competitors. But I think that maybe an alliance with Panama and Miami will help Miami really to become what they really want to be, is the gateway to the commerce of the United States.
Now, it should not surprise anyone in South Florida that Panama wants to exert its geography more in the trade industry. After all, the country generates $2.5 billion a year from tolls and fees associated with operating the canal. WLRN's America's editor Tim Padgett recently visited the canal zone. Tim, you're with us here in studio, and you found that much of that money may not be really bridging the widening economic gap in Panama.
No, that's been a constant problem for Panama ever since they took over the canal in 2000, was that, you know, they've turned it into more of a business rather than just as a utility, which was kind of the way the United States used to run it, and they've been enormously profitable with it. But the problem is, because you have such a highly stratified class structure in Panama, as well as a notoriously corrupt political system, so much of that revenue just gets eaten up by that elite, and it doesn't go to regular Panamanians.
Speaking of politics in Panama, there will be a new president, the vice president recently elected. Does that change the calculus involved in the trickle-down economics that may be operating with the canal zone and the wider, bigger ships?
Well, people are hoping so, particularly because the new president-elect, Juan Carlos Varela, campaigned on a platform of fighting corruption, particularly in the judicial system, where so many contracts just don't get respected, for example, in Panama. So there is hope that this complexion of things in Panama is going to change.
What about the necessary infrastructure, both capital infrastructure in terms of roads and rails, but also the respect for law and the court infrastructure that's necessary for Panama to exert its geography and a place where global finance can happen?
That's the big problem. Panama, you know, you just quoted, we just listened to Jorge Quijano, and one of his big messages is, look, we're not just selling the Panama Canal, we're selling Panama. Panama wants to become this global maritime and financial hub, sort of the Hong Kong of the Americas. And it wants to become sort of a one-stop shopping place, not just for shipping, but for financing cargo, for creating logistics. Mm-hmm. That's the big word they're using, logistics. And until they fix those corruption problems with the judicial system, you can't become the Hong Kong of the Americas until you become a place where people also have confidence that their contracts and agreements are going to be respected.
Well, stay with us here. Still to come on our program, the widening work has slowed down while the need for the business boost continues to come.
We're not sure that there's going to be a big shift in cargoes from the West Coast to the East Coast due to the opening of the Panama Canal.
This is the Sunshine Economy, faster, bigger, deeper trade and logistics in South Florida. I'm Tom Hudson. From the waterfront to the warehouse, there's plenty of excitement about the Miami Tunnel opening. The tunnel, along with the four new super post-Panamax cargo cranes dotting the Miami skyline, are probably the most visible signs of the hundreds of millions of dollars of public investment in the trade and logistics industry locally. Even though the trade business has been growing, credit rating agency Moody's is not so impressed. This month, Moody's cut its rating of almost $700 million of Port Miami's public IOUs.
Looking at the port's total debt profile, we don't think that there will be enough revenue to cover both its directly issued debt and the debt that was issued by the county starting in 2017 based on their own projections.
Myra Shankin is one of the analysts who downgraded the debt this month. She notes the county's own revenue projections given to Moody's do not reflect any increase in business that may come from the wider Panama Canal.
We're not sure that there's going to be a big shift in cargoes from the West Coast to the East Coast due to the opening of the Panama Canal. And the reason why we think that is because if you look at the cargo transit times from Asia to the U.S., if you were to put a box on a boat from Shanghai to Long Beach and then transfer it to rail, it's still quicker to get to the East Coast than it would be using the all-water service through the Panama Canal.
It is a race for time and money. Tim Padgett, WLRN's America's editor, still with us. You traveled to the canal zone a month ago, Tim. A lot riding on the wider canal opening up and swallowing up the cargo traffic that currently goes to the West Coast to bring it into the Gulf of Mexico and the East Coast. What's the status on the work?
Well, they claim, in my interview with Jorge Quijano, they claim that it's about 75% done, which makes this dispute that they're having with their main contractor, a consortium of European construction firms known as the GUPC, it makes that dispute all the more frustrating. It was a dispute that actually caused a work stoppage earlier this year.
This is a dispute between the main contractor, the consortium widening the canal, and the canal authority itself.
Right. And it's not just any old run-of-the-mill dispute. This is involving $1.6 billion in cost overrun claims, and that is that's a significant amount even for a project of this scale.
It's about 20% of the overall.
It's about a fifth of the overall, and it represents almost half, or it is half, I should say, of the $3.2 billion contract that this particular consortium and the authority had agreed upon.
What are the main sticking points? What are the main issues both sides are staking out?
Well, the consortium claims that it has run into unforeseen soil conditions. Among them, for example, higher than expected seismic activity along the canal zone. There's also, you know, disputes about concrete testing procedures, things that you would have thought a contractor and a client would have hashed out well before a project of this epic scale would have begun.
And Miami plays a key role not because of only it wants to accept the traffic to come through once the widening canal opens up, but this is the place that these sticking points are likely to be ironed out if they are.
Right. I think it's fitting that Miami was chosen as the venue for the international arbitration that the two sides have decided to go into. They're hoping that that arbitration will hash out these claims, who should be responsible for paying what, perhaps by the end of this summer. And if that is hashed out, well, then we won't have to worry about any future delays. We can get all this done by the end of next year.
And are there worries of future delays in Panama about the possibility of the slowdown in the work that's happened because of these sticking points between the main contractor and the canal authority?
Well, look, the delay that happened earlier this year already cost the Panama Canal an estimated $300 million, according to that's what Quijano told me. And so, yes, the stakes are high for both Panama and the U.S. port cities, who, even though they're spinning this as, well, not a big deal, they are counting on this canal expansion to help them recoup their own post-Panamax investments that they've made here.
What are the what's left? What's the big work left in the Canal Authority? And are the shovels still in the ground?
Shovels are still in the ground. It is an amazing sight when you go out to visit. It's like visiting some digitally created Hollywood epic. Mm. I mean, it is talking about 100-foot high concrete walls, 2 miles long. It's really something. But the main thing to get done now is getting the locks in place. They've been transported from Italy, and once those are in place next year, I think then we can breathe easier and assume that this is all going to get finished.
It really contrasts with the work that was done here in Port Miami, which is all underwater or underground. That right. work in the canal zone is right out in the open.
Oh, it is. And as I said, it's really something to see.
Tim Paget covering the Americas for us here at WLRN. Thank you, Tim. And you can see a video tour of the Port Miami Tunnel on our website at WLRN.org. This is the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. A new Miami tunnel represents really just a small link in the global competition over trade. It's a contest that South Florida certainly enjoys a geographic advantage for. But without aspiration or ambition, a tunnel can be just two holes dug in the dirt. This is the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.
I'm digging in the dirt. Digging in the dirt. I've got a shovel and a rake and a little dirt. How I'm gonna turn the earth and watch things grow. I'm digging in the dirt. And the rains come and the roots grow deep. And the sun shines and my plants come to be beautiful. Beautiful. Beautiful.